Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. And thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson. Florida made history this week. Felons who have served their time were able to register to vote without waiting for the state to give them the okay. More than a million felons had their rights restored. That's because Florida voters approved Amendment 4 last November. Anthony Bushell also is from Miami, and he had not been able to vote since the late 1990s, rather. But he says it was important for him to register just as soon as Amendment 4 went into effect this week.
I wanted to do my part as soon as possible versus having to wait and seeing how things go. Don't put my name in the beginning.
In Broward County, PJ Espinal said she's glad that counties have started accepting these new voters.
I believe that once you've punished your child, you don't hate them for the rest of their life. You bring them back and you give them a hug and you say, I love you. And now that you've done your time, let's move on.
Now, there is still some simmering confusion in some corners about how potential voters will be verified eligible to vote by the state. Some, like the new governor, Ron DeSantis, say the state legislature needs to pass a bill, needs a new law before Amendment 4 is fully implemented. Some say there is no need for that. Are you a felon who registered to vote this week? What was your experience like? Maybe a family member or a friend registered. Tell us about that. Share your experiences. Did you support Amendment 4 or did you vote against it in November? 800-743-WLRN is our phone number to join our conversation this week on the South Florida Roundup. 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet using our Twitter handle at WLRN. WLRN reporters Danny Rivero and Adej Green are with us, and this week for their whole hour to talk about a number of different legal issues, the Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle, and we're also joined by Joyce Griffin, the election of supervisors for Monroe County. Again, your questions, 800-743-9576. Danny, let's begin with you. You were out on Tuesday at election supervisor offices. What was that first day like?
So I was in the Miami-Dade Supervisor of Elections office in Doral, and it was a little slow. You know, Doral's not exactly in the city center, so it wasn't as busy as somewhere like Jacksonville. But there was somewhat of a steady stream of people coming in. I talked to some of them. People's hopes were up is what I can really say. You know, I had people telling me, you know, thank God I can register to vote. I've been watching from the sidelines for so long. Now I can finally, you know, go to the ballot box, show them how I feel. Hopefully, you know, some of my concerns will be addressed by politicians now.
And what was the process that they found on Tuesday? What did they actually have to do to register?
It was the same as it's ever been, basically. So the second question on the registration form is there's a box that says, you know, affirm that you are eligible to vote. And if you have a felony, that your rights have been regained. You've mm-hmm. regained your right to vote. So, you know, before Amendment 4 went into effect, you wouldn't be able to check that. But now, I mean, there's still lingering questions about, you know, yep. eligibility. But now, you know, people are checking, yes, my right to vote has been restored.
Yeah. Nadej, what are some of those questions that still remain?
I think one of the big questions is how it's going to be implemented. We've heard from Governor DeSantis that he believes that this is going to take some legislative action, the implementation of it all. But for the people who advocated for this to happen, they're saying that the language is clear. There should be nothing left. Like it's clear cut. But it's just a matter of whether or not the supervisors of elections, like how are they going to read it? How are you making sure that all of the different things like whether or not you've fulfilled your probation, mm-hmm. et cetera, has happened in order to vote. And so that is that gray area where the advocates and folks who really lobbied for this to happen, voters are saying, we voted for this. This is it. People can vote. But we're hearing from lawmakers like maybe not so much.
How about from election supervisors? Joyce Griffin, you experienced this firsthand as the leader of the election system in Monroe County in the Keys, a smaller population certainly than your three neighboring counties here in South Florida. But what was Tuesday like and Wednesday like for you?
Not much different than any other day. We had some phone calls. We had in our Key West office four people that we could tell had been felons because they came in and asked, you know, is today the day? So that way we know. But in reality, anybody who came into our office and filled out an application, we don't know if they were a felon before or not. Like the young man says, the question says, I have not been convicted of a felony, or if I have, my right to vote has been restored.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just mark the box. Supervisors of elections throughout the state are registering people to vote, and that is of not at question at all. That part, that the amendment said, let them register to vote, and they are registering to vote. I believe what the governor was talking about is there's other spots in the law that refers to felons. If you find out that someone is a felon, and what you do at that point, and the Division of Elections has been sending down felon information, and then there's a schedule. You know, we have to send them a letter within 7 days, and they have 30 days, and we have 30 days. It comes out to be close to 100 days this process takes. Well, I and the Division of Elections, and I'm not speaking for all supervisors, we have said we're putting a pause on that. Because
putting a pause on
the people that you find that are already registered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody comes in and says, well, this person shouldn't be voting. In the past, we get information that someone's a felon, and we send them a letter with paperwork showing, you know, their court.
Right.
Their court,
but would you do that today, though, given Amendment 4?
Right now we're on a pause. And I think that's
a pause, meaning that you could restart that?
Well, we're waiting for information because there are some people who have not served their debt to society that may be registered to vote. So we're waiting to get clarification from the legislature, and the Division of Elections is waiting to get clarification on where we should go with these voters. Because there is a law on the books that tells me what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
So because I'm not doing it, you could say that I'm breaking the law.
Joyce Griffin is the Monroe County Supervisor of Elections. Your questions and comments, concerns about the implementation of Amendment 4 here are welcome on the South Florida Roundup, 800-743-WLRN. Let me bring in the state attorney for Miami-Dade County, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle. Catherine, this week you had said that you would not go after any felon who tried to register to vote but found out they were ineligible to register to vote, just to the situation that the Monroe County supervisor election is discussing. What is your guidance?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I'm really happy to be here to be able to discuss this issue. It's something that I worked with both the legislature and the Florida a statewide grassroots effort through Desmond Mead for over a year. We've been talking about language and how to clear it, make it clear, and which felons to accept or not, and so on and so forth. So it is true that if you look around the United States, there have been arrests of folks who registered to vote. Many of them thought that they were entitled to register to vote, and then were either stopped or sometime later they were arrested and prosecuted for fraudulently registering to vote.
Right.
So when you read that and then you realize that right now, you know, as of Tuesday, we were beginning this process, I wanted to make clear that this office, the Dade State Attorney's Office, is not going to prosecute someone who registered, who believes they were eligible to register. We're just not going to prosecute those cases. And I sort of agree with the advocates who were in favor of this amendment, who say that really it's very self-actuating, you know, it's self-executing,
mm-hmm.
and that there should not have to be any legislative or executive action to be taken to make this amendment real. And I was happy to read, I'm not familiar with why DeSantis said what he did, but I was happy to read in an article recently the new Speaker of the House, Jose Olivia.
Right, from Hialeah.
From Hialeah, right. Says that it is the will of the people.
Yeah.
And that he will be executing this as the will of the
people.
But
back to this issue even that Joyce Griffin in Monroe County has identified, and you came out ahead of Tuesday saying you weren't going to prosecute any felon that registered to vote thinking that they were eligible that perhaps weren't eligible. Joyce Griffin in Monroe County, I mean, your concern is about submitting false information on a registration.
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay, help clarify for me then.
Okay.
Because just to that point, is submitting false information on a registration affidavit is a third-degree felony.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So your concern isn't somebody submitting false information.
Well, that's not what I was talking about. I am concerned about it because, like the lady said, I'm sorry, I didn't catch her name. This goes back. You could have committed a felony in 1940 and think you paid all your fines, but you didn't pay a fine. And, you know, if that comes out, then, you know, I think that there's going to have to be. I don't know. I'm not a judge, and that's certainly not my job. I have no power that way. But I'm hoping that people would realize maybe people thought it had been a very long time, because there are a lot of people who did made their mistake a long time ago.
Right, but what can't. Understood. Well, how is that different, though, Joyce? But how is that different than submitting false information? Even if you think it's true, you're still submitting false information.
Yes, you are. You absolutely are.
You know, one thing.
You know, and I'm not saying that, but what I wanted to get to was what I was talking about, I believe the governor was talking about. He was saying that we have to look at some laws on the book, and there are laws on the book that maybe they just need to be taken off, because there was laws on the book on how to deal with people who registered that maybe committed a felony after they registered. Those laws have to be addressed because they're on the books. We can't turn our back on them. But that's not saying we're not registering. All the supervisors in the state of Florida are registered.
Right.
You could go on my website,
right,
keyselections.org, and register to vote. Just answer the questions.
Right.
If you have a driver's license or a Florida ID, the people who have served their debt to society are, and they should be, allowed to register to vote today.
Okay, Catherine Fernandez-Rundle, let me ask you, the Miami-Dade state attorney, just to respond to one of the questions that Joyce Griffin, the Monroe County supervisor, had there regarding fines. For instance, the hypothetical put forth, somebody convicted of a felony in 1940 finds out that there's still some outstanding fine for what is that considered part of their sentence? If that fine has not been paid in full, is that considered part of their sentence or probation?
Well, I do think that that is the one gray area. What is the completion of the sentence? And we've been talking about this within my office with our legal division and so on and so forth. And I think that's somewhat different from what I think the supervisor of elections is saying from Monroe County. There are lots of people. So the amendment accepts people who have been convicted of murder or sexual offenses. So they may not know. So there are like.
It exempts them.
In other words, they do not
they
have.
They do not have the right restored
correct.
Here. Right.
Right. So. You know, they maybe people don't recognize that, for instance, under sexual offenses, there's like 30 different offenses that would make you ineligible to register to vote. So there may be someone may file, you know, go to register to vote. It may bounce back and say, no, you're not eligible to vote because of such and such. So that's pretty, I think, straightforward. I think where the gray area may come in is where the language in the amendment, in fact, when I was working with the state legislature, who withdrew theirs when the People's Amendment won the power by the Supreme Court to move forward so there wouldn't be confusion, I was working with the state legislature on just that issue. What is completion of the sentence? So someone had to pay restitution, for instance, to a victim, and it was not done. A, who knows that? Who determines that? And what do we do with that?
Yeah. Danny Rivera, you've done some reporting on this. What has that led you to find?
Well, I've been talking to different clerks of courts offices across the state. And, you know, because they're the ones that they hold a lot of the databases as to, you know, what someone was sentenced to, if they've paid their fines or court costs or whatnot. And they've told me the state's association for clerks and comptrollers, they've told me they're actually just waiting on information from someone in the state, whether that be the legislature or some the state division of elections.
Like waiting for clarification.
Waiting for clarifications, yeah. Because they're saying, you know, they hold the records, but they don't consider themselves in a position to interpret the amendment's language and to decide ultimately if someone does meet that criteria of finishing their sentence or not. So they're actually just kind of waiting right now.
Nadezh, how about the advocates? What do they say about this dictionary debate right now about what it means to complete a sentence in probation?
I think this conversation has raised a lot of concern over whether or not this will be followed through as the intent was, or whether or not this will create additional roadblocks. Like now we have a reason not to allow this group that technically is allowed to vote, right, with the exemptions that exist. But because of this thing now, it's like, well, here's a whole host of other reasons why you can't vote still. You know, someone had mentioned, like, you know, it's almost like a tax, like make sure you pay this before you're able to vote. And what are the implications of that? But again, the advocates that I've spoken to and the people out in the community have said that they're ready to vote. Like, it's not ambiguous for them that this means that they are able to vote.
I'm sorry.
Joyce Griffin, with Monroe County. Go ahead.
This question on the form is question number two. Question number one says, are you a United States citizen? Question two is, are you a felon? Do you have your rights restored? Question three, have you ever been adjudicated mentally incompetent? If so, have you had your rights restored? All of these questions have the same legal weight. All of these people are registering. There's not going to be any doubt. There shouldn't be any scaring for these people. Bright and early on Tuesday morning, I went to someone I knew that had been a felon way in the day and registered them to vote. They were thrilled to death to finally get their registration. Mm-hmm. And people are registering online. There is no scare. These people are registering. Yeah. But as was said, there are some laws that we need clarification on. We're not stopping anybody from voting. We just need to know. Here's a law.
Understood, Joyce. But this, to this question, Catherine, I mean, you're a veteran a prosecutor. What does it mean when one says a sentence and probation is completed?
Okay, so first of all, I really do agree full-heartedly with the concept. This should not become a fear factor. Okay, this whole dialogue and this conversation could have the adverse effect.
So is this all a red herring then? Is this all settled law already?
Well, probation is pretty self, you know, that's pretty easy to determine whether you, and most people know that. That's the easy one. On the restitution one, my view would be, and we'll see if this is upheld by my colleagues and the legislature, but my view would be, let them register to vote. If someone wants to assert later, oh, by the way, I heard that my neighbor who owed me money for the car he broke into, whatever, he didn't pay me. I would take the view at that point what we do is see if we can convert the criminal order for restitution into a civil order. And so I really do believe that that can happen so that we could then say to the victim, look, if you want this $200 for the broken windshield or whatever it might be, let's see if we can convert that into a civil order, because you do have, even with a court order of restitution in a criminal court, you have the ability to enforce it in civil court. So that's one position that I would take as we move forward on this issue.
We've got a phone call here on the South Florida Roundup. You can join the conversation, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576, talking about the implementation of the first few days of Amendment 4, the restoration of rights, voting rights for felons in Florida. Catherine Fernandez-Rundle is our guest for the whole hour, the state attorney in Miami-Dade County. Joyce Griffin is the Monroe County election supervisor. She's with us for this segment. Mark, in Miami, you are up first. Thanks for holding on and calling. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that the reason why people might be skeptical of any, you know, manipulating of what was voted on is the awful way in which the past Florida governor and the administration and the cabinet just really abused felons and their position. It's awful. I didn't care one way or the other about politics until I saw how they abused felons. I happen to be a felon. And it just created so much anger in me that I'm so involved now. And keep in mind, I mean, it was awful what happened to it. Thank you.
Mark, we appreciate it. Thank you for your thoughts. Certainly there has been a history of that kind of voting issue in Florida when it comes to lots of different folks. But how we got to this point was a significant decrease in the clemency board's willingness to restore the rights of all kinds of felons, Danny and Nadej. We saw some reporting out of the Palm Beach Post, for instance, about the exponential decrease in the number of voting rights restoration cases that the Scott Clemency Board happened to grant, which led to court cases, which led to the citizens' position that wound up on the ballot.
That's exactly right. And I actually talked to Joyce Griffin on the phone a couple of weeks ago, and as I recall it, she told me, you know, this amendment is finally going to make it not arbitrary. It's not going to depend on who's governor if I get my rights back or not. Because as it was, you know, you had Governor Jeb Bush had one take on it, Charlie Crist another one, Rick Scott came in and it went down dramatically. Mm-hmm. And then now with the new governor, you don't really know where it's going to go. But now with the Amendment 4, you have a clear language that says your rights shall be restored on this condition of your sentence being fulfilled. Now the question is, what does that mean? But it's still pretty, it's a lot clearer than it was beforehand.
Yeah, I wouldn't know because I'm sure the state attorney has a better grip on this, but I would think the majority of the people, it's very cut. You know, I paid my restitution and I paid my time. I did my probation. I'm free. And those people, I think the majority of the people know. There might be one or two or, you know, a few out there. I have no idea. But I think the ones with the questions, well, I can't remember if I really paid my fees or not. But I would have thought if they didn't pay their fees, somebody would have tapped them on the shoulder by now. I think that the majority of the people, it's clear cut. Go to the website, register to vote today. Because don't forget, we have an election in March of 2020.
Elections even sooner than that, Nadej, in some municipalities.
Yes. Tom, I agree with that 100%. I think we just go register. If you know, you'll find out if someone has an objection later to either a court cross or a restitution. I would not allow. I would really advocate that not be a stumbling block. And back to your point about it is so true. The grand jury did a report just last year, July 2018, and it studied. And that felon who said that the clemency board treated them so poorly is absolutely right. In that period of time, for the last 8 years, it was something like 2,000 felons mm-hmm. had their rights restored. Whereas previous years, when Governor Crist and Jeb Bush went, we were talking about in the tens of thousands. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the arbitrariness of it, it was really a slap in the face to those that wanted to go back into the communities. We want them. Those of us in law enforcement see this as a public safety issue. We see it not just as a rights issue, a morality issue, but also as an issue for the community. Because we know the recidivism rates of those whose rights were restored is much lower than those whose rights have not been restored. And obviously, if a person comes out and has the wherewithal to go on with a life, getting a job, and we'll have more stability and would be a contributing member of our community as opposed to have no other option.
Catherine Fernandez-Rundle is our guest for the whole hour, Miami-Dade State Attorney. We got a lot more legal issues to talk about that were on the ballot in November and are now in the Florida State Constitution. Joyce Griffin, thank you for your thoughts and experiences from the Keys. She is the Monroe County Supervisor of Elections. Joyce, thank you so much. Nadej Green also along with us. Danny Rivero as well. Your phone calls. We're going to be talking about Marcy's Law up next. This other statewide constitutional amendment regarding law enforcement addressing crime victims' rights. 800-743-WLRN. What questions do you have about the right of crime victims in Florida? 800-743-9576 as the roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson. Floridians passed Amendment 6 this past election. It was one of those bundled amendments, sandwiched questions about judges and what's known as Marcy's Law together. Now, Marcy's Law is a version of a law that's been passed in several states. It adds a more detailed list of victims' rights to the Florida Constitution. Despite that detailed list, everyone from public defenders to sheriffs to Department of Corrections find the law to be vague. The Senate Criminal Justice Committee held a panel this week asking lawmakers for clarification on it. Part of Florida's Marcy's Law amendment requires victims to be notified of every step in a criminal case. Eighth Circuit State Attorney Bill Savone worries that it will have far-reaching consequences for the criminal justice system.
This is going to exponentially increase the problem of making sure that we have notification and cause delay, because I assume every judge is going to be even more scrupulous now with saying to me, do you have constitutionally required input? And if I say no, he is going to say, come back next week.
Public defender Stacey Scott wants lawmakers to balance victims' rights with the rights of the accused.
We would encourage you to take a common sense view of Amendment 6 that acknowledges the strong victims' rights laws that balances and ensures that the constitutional rights of the accused aren't diminished by virtue of the implementation of this amendment.
If you have been a crime victim, how has that experience with the criminal justice system affected you? How does this new amendment change the rights of victims? And what about the rights of the accused under this new language in Florida's Constitution? 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN on the telephone. You can also find us on Twitter at WLRN. The Miami-Dade County State Attorney, Catherine Fernandez-Rundel, continues with us. She supported Amendment 6. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero is along with us, and Carolina Bellato covers Florida courts for law360.com as well. So, Danny, a lot happening in Marcy's Law. What are some of the highlights that are now in the Constitution?
So a lot of what Marcy's Law is was already in the Constitution in some form or another. 30 years ago in 1988, voters actually passed a constitutional amendment which put a lot of victims' rights in the state Constitution. What I've heard from civil rights groups and as well as prosecutors and defense attorneys is they're concerned with one particular part of it, mm-hmm. and that's the phrase used to be in the Constitution and it got removed, the part that says the victims shall be heard at all steps along the process to the extent that these rights do not interfere with the constitutional rights of the accused. Mm-hmm. Now, that provision is no longer in there, and that has a lot of people very concerned because, you know, now if the victim is on equal footing with the person who's being prosecuted by the state, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that the defendant's rights always have to be kind of on the same mm-hmm. terms. I'm sorry, I'm bundling it, but basically you're putting them on equal footing,
right?
And that's not typically how criminal prosecutions have worked in the United States.
Yeah, Carolina, a criminal prosecution is between the accused and the state, a government entity usually. It's not between two individuals. It's not a criminal case is not between the accused and the victim.
Right, and that's what I've heard the same thing. I've heard the exact same thing from people I've talked to. The new you mentioned the old wording in the Constitution. The new wording is the exact wording is victims' rights and interests are to be respected and protected by law in a manner no less vigorous than protections afforded to criminal defendants and juvenile delinquents. So there is concern that this is going to infringe on or you know butt up against the rights of the accused, which is important.
Due process, Catherine, you supported this amendment. Does this erode due process?
I don't believe it does at all. I do not believe, and I, first and foremost, I deeply believe in due process and the rights of the accused. I don't know any good lawyer or prosecutor that doesn't. You know, defendants' rights, the accused's rights are protected not just in the state constitution, but also in the U.S.
Sure,
constitution.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm of a different view. I think that the opponents to this and my good friend Bill Chavone and I have had many discussions about this. Scott Stacey, I mean, Stacey Scott is a good friend, and we've been on different committees together. And my view of this is that it doesn't infringe on it at all, none whatsoever. I think that their concern is it's going to be more work. All right? That's what Bill talks about.
More work in terms of notifications.
Notification, yes. So in my office, we've been doing this for years. And so in my view is more work. Well, you know what? That's okay. Because if you're a victim of a crime, there are many occasions, although there was that overall overreaching said you had the rights, the truth of the matter is that case after case was very dependent on the judge. And I have a prime example of where two girls who had been sexually abused by someone lived in different parts of the state of Florida. Sentencing came up for the accused. They got in their cars at like 5 o'clock in the morning to drive down to Dade County to go to court and stand in the courtroom, which is really hard to do, mm-hmm. and tell the court and everyone that's listening how that crime how that person impacted your life and how you're traumatized. They got all the way into the court and the judge just looked at them and said, I know exactly what you're going to say. I don't need to hear from you. So what this really does, yeah, they had the right to be there. But you know what? Now we have an enforceable, excuse me, Your Honor, there's a right here that's under the state constitution.
So what is the new right then?
Which is higher.
What is the, do they get 3 minutes to address the court, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 6 hours?
Well, it's like anything else. What's
right?
reasonable?
Okay.
I mean, the court is always in charge of their courtroom. The judge is in charge of that courtroom. The difference is the constitution is a higher right than just a state statute. And so a lot of this may just be the ability to argue and advocate better for the victims. It may be the ability to make sure that the victims feel that they are a respected integral part of the whole criminal justice process. It is by no means intended to impede or infringe on the accused's rights whatsoever.
I'm curious to hear your thoughts about the provisions in the that I think have been what civil rights advocates have told me is the most problematic is the caps on appeals for death penalty cases. The law caps appeals for death penalty cases at 5 years and for non-death penalty cases at 2 years, which seems fast, seems like a short amount of time. And also, you know, we lead the Florida leads the nation in exonerations from death penalty cases. So
we couldn't agree more. Catalina, in fact, when we were working with the Marcy's folks from around the country, we looked at that provision, and Dade County, as you might imagine, that those they wanted a shorter period. I believe it was 2 years. I don't have that in front of me. And we said that that's impossible. So what we did was they extended some of the period of time, and they added language. I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it says, unless otherwise necessary. So there is sort of that escape clause, if you like. If you need more time on these appellate issues, you get more time. We all want that because that's just not only the right thing to do, but we're just going to be burdening a system that's going to lead to more post-conviction appeals anyway.
And just to follow up with Catalina, something that I've heard from advocates and civil rights groups that concerns them is they're looking at how this has been implemented in other states. And in somewhere like South Dakota, they had this They passed an amendment a couple of years ago. They ran into issues because they interpreted a victim to mean like a business. So if a corner store was robbed, the interpretation they took was, okay, well, now we need to protect the right of the victim, the store, and shield some of that information. So the police departments couldn't say, you know, the corner store on 8th Street got robbed, so they couldn't get tips back. And it actually became an issue for law enforcement because they couldn't share basic information.
Yeah, this is a provision of the exemption of personal information from victims or of victims in these public files. If the victim is a business or a location as opposed to an individual.
Well, okay, a couple of things. I have heard that the person would now include corporations. It's always been that way in the law. Person has always included corporations, LLCs, and so on and so forth. So what the protection is really for a larger audience. The defendant is always, and I feel kind of bad for those that go out there and say, oh, their victims' names won't be out there. Well, the defendant is always going to receive the name of the victim, and anyone else is going to testify against that defendant. They have the right to be confronted by their accuser. They have the right to have that person.
But this concern more is even in law enforcement. You know, if there's a spate of burglaries in a certain block, Marcy's Law arguably could be used to shield that location information, not to have that included in public information.
Well, for law enforcement purposes, I don't believe it would be shielded. I believe, I mean, I'll relook that and make sure that I'm certain about it, that I'm right. But my understanding is that law enforcement will always have access to that kind of intelligence information, and they're always going to be using that to see if there's a pattern, to help them with unfounded criminal cases, other burglaries, for instance.
So to clarify, I mean, part of the issue as it's rolled out in South Dakota is not that law enforcement doesn't have that information. It's the limited ability to share that with the public. So if you're seeking you know, was there a witness to this crime at this location? You know, it could potentially affect us as journalists because, you know, we have broad public records laws here in the state of Florida. In the Sunshine Laws, now there's a little bit of a gray area. Can I get that public record if it says this address, or can I not get that public record?
Well, let me ask you, does South Dakota particularly address that issue? I'm not familiar with South Dakota.
They actually had to go back and amend what the Marcy's Law as it was. They amended it a couple months ago because they had all these issues.
And I think that's an important point. Mm. So that if there's a part of a law that isn't working, whether it's a state statute or it's a state constitution, we always have the right to go back and fix it, glitch bills and things like that. So if you're right, and I'm not, you may be, I'm not certain, I hadn't looked at it from that perspective, but if that's something that is of an issue, you always have the right to go back and tweak it, fix it, improve upon it. So,
how retroactive is this law? Are you having to go back through your files and active prosecutions that are underway right now and having to fulfill obligations, new obligations that are now enshrined in the Constitution because of Amendment 6?
Actually, it's interesting you should say that, Tom, because in talking to some of the folks around the state of Florida, we've been doing this for so long through our different notification upon arrest, notification of coming to court, notification of sentencing, notification when you're getting out of jail, notification when you're, you know, coming out of state prison. So we've been doing this for such a long time that I just don't believe it's going to have anything but a positive impact for our victim population.
Does it elevate the role of the victim in a criminal proceeding?
I believe that it's a higher protection of their rights when you're in the state constitution as opposed to in a state statute.
And were victim rights threatened without this kind of amendment?
I don't think they were threatened. I think it gave more discretion to various jurisdictions as to how they wanted to do it. You know, every jurisdiction has a different way of dealing with their victim population. We happen to be very victim trauma based. Hmm. So we're always very focused on our victim population. We feel we're their advocates. So I believe this, in some respects, is really to make sure that there's a uniform process around the state of Florida, that the victims, they themselves, have a greater sense of confidence in the criminal justice system, that they have a voice, and that they're going to have an impact somewhere, that they're not lost, which many of them feel now. Sometimes I always feel, and they will tell you, as a victim, the process unfortunately re-victimizes a lot of victims.
And does this somehow address that?
I believe it will, just by the example that I gave you. So those two victims that wanted to go to court and express themselves, left with a sense of justice wasn't there for them.
Right, because the judge wouldn't allow them.
They wouldn't allow them to speak.
Right. Catherine Fernandez-Rundle is with us, our guest here, the Miami-Dade County State Attorney. Other legal issues we're going to talk to, Danny Rivero with WLRN, Carolina Bellotto with Law360.com, following the justice system here in South Florida and throughout the Sunshine State as well. A new Florida State Supreme Court justice from Hialeah on the high bench. We'll talk about that next as the South Florida Roundup continues after this. Back on the South Florida Roundup this week on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Governor Ron DeSantis wasting no time in his first week in office. The day after his inauguration, he announced his first judicial appointment for the Florida Supreme Court, South Florida Appellate Judge Barbara Lagoa.
She will be the first Hispanic woman ever to be on the Supreme Court of Florida. Of all the nominees, and they were all great nominees on this list, she clearly had the most judicial experience.
It is a list, by the way, that the new governor gets two more picks from. Lagoa accepted her job at the Freedom Tower here in South Florida, in Miami, where her parents were processed as exiles from Cuba.
Like so many others, came to this country from Cuba to start rebuilding their lives in a land that offered them opportunity, but more importantly, freedom.
Justice Lagoa from Hialeah, from South Florida, and more than a decade of experience on the bench here in South Florida. Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez-Rundle, certainly familiar with the new justice. WLRN's Danny Rivero and Carolina Bellotto along with us. Carolina covers Florida courts for Law360.com. Carolina, what can you tell us about the new justice of the Supreme Court?
She spent 12 years in the Third District Court of Appeal, which covers Miami-Dade and Monroe counties. She is a well-respected jurist. I've spoken to attorneys on both sides of the aisle, and everyone seems happy with this pick. And she, you know, she went up there and she echoed what Governor DeSantis said about separation of powers and a more limited role for the judiciary, which I think is where we're going to see the court move with, you know, in the next few months.
Talk to us a little bit about her appointment and, of course, the two others that the governor has required because of the mandatory retirement age on the Florida Supreme Court. Three justices hit that. They retired.
Right.
So the new governor is certainly interested in reshaping the high judiciary and is doing that with this first appointment with this justice.
Right. So there are 11 names sent to the governor. There were three from Miami. One of the seats had to be from Miami. So we knew it was either going to be Lagoa, Judge Luck, or Mr. Curiel,
yeah,
who's an attorney. Her odds were pretty good. So we're going to see two more. You know, they are, from what I've spoken to a lot of attorneys, and from what they've told me, this is a pretty good list of attorneys and judges who are well-respected, certainly conservative. And they're going to – it's very much going to change. The court before was a 4-3 liberal conservative split,
right,
and it's definitely going to be like a 6-1 now. So it's going to be a much more business-friendly conservative court. I think what we're going to see is a lot of often in 4-3 decisions with the liberals in the majority, the dissent says we don't have jurisdiction. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that. Just the court deciding we're not going to take up this case because – we don't have jurisdiction. They define jurisdiction a lot more narrowly, I think, than the more liberal justices do.
And oftentimes on those dissenting opinions, what we saw is the high court putting that jurisdiction back to the legislature.
Right. That happens a lot.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see that more and more. That's basically those dissenters are going to be in the majority now.
Catherine Fernandez-Rundel is a long-serving state attorney here in Miami-Dade County. You know these legal circles well. What are your thoughts about Justice Lagoa?
Well, I'm just so excited. And, you know, to sort of echo what Christina said, the three from Miami were just outstanding candidates. And I was very blessed that the governor's office and his general counsel at the time would always welcome input from myself in the office.
Did you give that input?
I did.
Yeah.
And I was very proud to be able to give input on those three very justified, qualified candidates.
Characterize that input. What were those questions about? Was it about jurisprudence, or was it more character or personality?
I think it's character, personality, reputation. How are they viewed in
temperament?
Temperament,
yeah.
You know, and also, you know, how they handle their opinions, how they write their orders, and for instance, Robert Luck had been in our criminal division, so I was able to give input on
one of those also on the short list.
One of them also on the short list, and like Christina said, he could still be appointed,
yeah,
because they're at
and
large.
He's very highly respected. He's, a lot of people I've spoken to really like Judge Luck.
Very highly respected, and of course, so was Barbara. Art Curiel, I don't know as well because I think he comes from the federal system. But just on Barbara, I just have to tell you that we were like doing cartwheels yesterday. And when I mean by we, it was a lot of Cubans, Cuban-Americans, and also Cuban-American women and just women in general. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were texting each other and we were just so excited. And last night, I think I mentioned this off air, I was trying to reach her just to congratulate her and ran in coincidentally and into her husband. It was like 9:30 at night. We were just both coming home from work and we were in the grocery store parking lot. And I'm going in. He's coming out. He's got this pile of newspapers. And by the time I got to the store, there were no newspapers left. And it was so cool. And we lifted one up. And he was ecstatic. He told me the three girls. She's a mother of twins. Yeah. I'm a mother of twins. And, you know, she's just got such a great story. Such a second generation of immigrant parents. You know, FIU.
FIU grad.
Graduate,
Columbia Law.
Law Review. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's just stellar. Was it the
I
U.S.?
I think the governor said that she's the first FIU grad who's going to be on the Florida Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's another first, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just wonderful. So we all wish her all the best and congratulations to the governor for making a wise choice. And just as a side note, I'm told that the governor's new public information officers, Helen Aguirre. I don't know if you know Helen Aguirre.
Helen Frey, right? She used to be on Channel 2
here.
That's
correct.
Right.
And that the Freedom Tower was sort of her brainchild. I don't know if that's true, but that's
To have Miami-Dade County College, College take it over.
And that's where she came from, and then it was
her advice.
But
you're saying the setting to do this appointment at the Freedom Tower.
That's what I'm told, which I thought was really very special.
What about that temperament, though? Tell us about the temperament. The story is compelling, certainly, but the judicial temperament that's now going to be on the Supreme Court in the form of Justice Lagoa is what?
Well, first of all, she brings to the court a whole bunch of assets, and she brings a really good temperament and character, and she brings a well-rounded view of the world, and that's what you really want. You want somebody that understands different aspects of life. But I do agree with Carolina's assessment that the way she herself, and I'm quoting this, I think, from what she said the other day during her acceptance speech, she says, "I'm particularly mindful of the fact that under our constitutional system, it is for the legislature, not the courts, to make the law. It is the role of judges to apply and not to alter the work of the people's representatives."
Yeah, I think it was obviously a very popular decision, and it's one of the hallmarks of really kind of a splashy first week for our new governor here. He made several major announcements. One of the first things he did was come down here to Miami, throw yet another bone to the Cuban American community here. His Lieutenant Governor Nunez is Cuban American,
right,
as well.
Right, Jeanette Nunez. Yeah.
It's been a busy
and
week.
I believe she's another first.
First Cuban-American.
Cuban-American Lieutenant Governor.
Yeah. Female.
Right. Catherine Fernandez-Rendell, though, in her final moments here, as the top prosecutor in the most populous state, most populous county, neighboring Broward County, later on today it's expected that Sheriff Scott Israel in Broward County is likely to be suspended by the new governor. Any thoughts on that action and Sheriff Israel?
You know, I have to tell you, I've worked so much with the family members, particularly the students, and one of the students, David Bogg, and I went up to Washington, D.C. last March to go to our Congress and say, you got to pass some really basic, necessary firearms laws. And so I really feel that a lot of it deals with those families, that community, and their sheriff.
But do you support the governor's ability to do this kind of suspension to an elected sheriff?
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I just don't. I mean, I'm sure that he's done his research. And if that was a promise he made, then I honor that he's the sort of person that he would do his homework and he would know that he has the ability to do that. I'm familiar with the governor's right to suspend somebody when they're convicted of a felon or charged with a felon and discretionary with misdemeanors. This area I'm not familiar. I didn't know you were going to ask me that question. I would have done my homework.
Well, more about your thoughts and your impressions in that. Had you worked with Sheriff Israel?
I did. I worked with Scott Israel over the years. I've done a lot of law enforcement strategy. I've spoken and a number of statewide gatherings, and I always found him to be real professional.
Catherine, we have to leave it there. Catherine Fernandez-Rendell, the state attorney in Miami-Dade County, Danny Rivero with WLRN, Carolina Bellato with Law360.com. Thanks to all of you. Finally, on the South Florida Roundup this week,
Miami has the Dolphins, the greatest football team.
In a really tight job market, there's one job that a lot of South Floridians are interested in: head coach of the Miami Dolphins.
And when you say Miami, you're talking Super Bowl, because we're the...
Well, WLRN asked listeners, what's the one thing they'd do if they got to be head coach of the Dolphins for a day? We hear first from John in Miami.
First and foremost, trade or cut Ryan Tannehill. Tannehill's always been a ball and chain on this team for the last 7 years. He lacks creativity, he has no initiative on the field, he doesn't inspire the offense, and it doesn't matter who the coach is or who the offensive coordinator is, he simply can't achieve anything above mediocrity.
My name is Alex, and I live in Coral Gables, Florida. What I would change about the Miami Dolphins is shift to a community ownership model to mirror that of the Green Bay Packers.
This is Michael Spoliansky from Fort Lauderdale and a lifelong Dolphins fan, and if I could take over the Miami Dolphins, I would fire the quarterback, Ryan Tannehill, because he is overpaid and mediocre at best.
Miami has the Dolphins.
Well, regardless of who the Dolphins head coach is, we can be confident that Miami will be in the Super Bowl in 2020. Yeah, we host the game here. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado, our digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Director of Radio Operations, Peter J. Meritz. And our director of Radio Programming and Technical Supervisor is Jason Zabka, also a New England Patriots fan. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening.